This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Back in December, the United States Sentencing Commission changed the federal sentencing guidelines and will now retroactively reduce sentences for crack cocaine offenders. They were typically sentenced to 50% more jail time than powder cocaine offenders. The new guidelines take effect this coming Monday. Just over 1,500 convicts can apply for immediate release, and an additional 19,000 could be eligible for shorter sentences over the next 30 years, but all of them will have served lengthy terms in prison. After many years inside, ex-prisoners face challenges as they try to figure out a world that's changed a great deal over the past 10 or 20 or 30 years. There are big issues like employment and housing discrimination and lots of smaller ones like feeling overwhelmed by technology and culture. If you'd like to talk with former prisoners about dealing with those changes, give us a call. Or if you've been through this experience yourself, what surprised you? Give us your story. Our number is 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. And you can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the program, a blog that tries to get us to rethink stereotypes by writing about what white people like. But first, life after prison. And we begin with Angel Ramos. He spent 30 years in prison after being convicted of murder. He currently works as a counselor for the Fortune Society, a nonprofit prisoner advocacy group, and joins us now from our bureau in New York. And nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Hi.
And what surprised you after you got out of prison, what, just less than a year ago?
Well, just about everything. Technology, cell phones, especially. I could actually program them, but I just couldn't operate one.
The last time you used a telephone, probably on the outside, it was connected to a wall.
Yes, and in prison they didn't have telephones for a while, and then they allowed phones.
There must be also, after a lifetime, it must seem like a lifetime, 30 years of regimentation, doing the same things at the same times every day. Was it difficult to deal with a life that's not that regimented?
Well, I was fortunate in that I came to live at the Fortune Academy. That's the residence that the Fortune Society has. And so they helped me with transition, and which was great. Calm down, work on yourself. There are issues that you need to take care of and address before you needed a space to stand. There's a lot of things that happen to guys that come out, and they really, what they need is a vacation, to be honest with you. And just to get adopted to the world, it's hard.
Some things, even like going in, that you would take for granted, but like going into a supermarket can seem like a pretty big surprise.
Oh my God, I was overwhelmed. I went to the supermarket to buy a can of spaghetti sauce, and I went on the and I just got so frightened. There were just so many of them. I was like, oh my God, all I want is spaghetti sauce.
It was incredible. Nobody just regular spaghetti sauce.
I ran out and didn't get the spaghetti sauce. By the way,
what was it like trying to find a job?
Oh, that was difficult. But like I said, I happened to be fortunate in that I landed up with the Fortune Society, and so they have classes that they, job training and how to address the conviction question, and for me, I did a lot of work inside, and I was, I had a lot of friends, and I had remade my life. I was fortunate that they still had collars before Pataki cut it off, so I did go to college. And I learned to program computers, and so I read a lot. So I kind of knew the world, but not knew the world at the same time.
Now, you mentioned Pataki, former New York Governor George Pataki, and there were cuts in the programs offered for prisoners during his administration. That's just not New York State. That's been a lot of places.
Yeah, but it made no sense. He got rid of the only program that had empirical data showing that it had a positive effect against fighting crime. I mean, you were supposed to be fighting crime, so why ain't you fighting crime? You give people education, you give them a different idea that maybe that they could do something different in life. They don't have to rob and steal and sell drugs. They could say, well, I could actually work in an office. I have the skills, or I can, do whatever. But, sometimes people just, it's easier to hurt someone than to help them, because in order to help them, you have to really get involved in their lives, and who wants to do that?
We'd like to get listeners involved in this conversation. If you've done time, what was it like getting out and readjusting to society? Or if you want to talk with prisoners about their experience, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Jacob is on the line. He's calling us from Salt Lake City in Utah.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to give, my own experience. I was a bit young. I was 19, and I did 21 months total time about a year in jail, then almost a year in federal prison, and about 2 months at a halfway house. And I found it really interesting when I got out. I was in a halfway house, and I was applying for about 8 jobs a week, and these are pretty low jobs as far as, like, you know, I didn't have a business degree or anything, so I wasn't going for an office job, just cashiers, things like that. And I'm a little bit outside, I guess, quote-unquote, the norm, where I was a very clean-cut-looking guy. I'm fairly confident in my abilities, blah, blah, blah. But every single interview for a period of 2 to 3 weeks of many, many interviews, as soon as a felony came up, people would just really slam the door on my face. It was really interesting. And I thought, here I am. I'm a very clean-cut-looking guy. I have a little bit going on for me as far as really supportive family members and people around me who didn't abandon me or anything during my time. And it was really difficult for me to get a job. How are some of these more disenfranchised people going to even survive? And I think that's part of the problem for our huge recidivism rate. So,
Angel Ramos, does that sound familiar? The looks that Jacob's reporting when as soon as he mentions the felony.
Oh yeah, I went on a couple of those interviews, but the thing is, you know, I brought a different spirit out. You know, I was free. You know, relatively so. But I was free, and I was, you know, I was enjoying life, and I wasn't going to allow people to judge me. I'm not the, as my friend tells me, I'm not the worst thing that I've ever done in life. I am different. I am a better human being, you know. And I used to go to those interviews, and I was just, I'll be honest with you, I was honored to be there and to meet them and that spirit. And I don't care if you give me a job. I'm just want to talk to you. I mean, I haven't talked to anyone in so long. It was just great, you know. So, actually, I was given a call back on a couple of jobs, but one was very far away, and I was like, oh my God, I got to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning just to get there at 7, and it was like, oh, and I had to take a bus and a train, and I'm like, you know, by the time I get finished paying for all that, you know, I'm still in the hole.
Yeah, Jacob, did you find work?
You know, I only finally found work through my mom. She talked with her boss, and they gave me a really low-paying job, but it was a start, and I eventually able to get a little bit more experience under my belt so I could get my felony more becomes inconsequential when you know, my skills kind of rise in business.
And the further away it is, yeah, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I felt like if I didn't have the support, I would see how it would be very easy to fall back into, you know, crime that got people back into prison.
Regrettably, most do. Jacob, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you very much.
And good luck to you. Angel Ramos, let me also ask you, obviously, the social mores are a little bit different in prison than they are on the outside. Did you have to adjust your behavior in any way?
Well, I'm still adjusting my behavior. You put on a uniform when you go in there. It's like a suit of armor to survive, and you adopt code of behaviors that are really antisocial out here, but you put them on. And some of these, you put them on, and you don't even realize you have them. And then when you come out, you say, oh, my God, you know, people pushing you and shoving you and looking at you. You know, in prison, they look at you and use it as a challenge, you know. Mm-hmm. And if somebody bumps into you, it's a challenge. But in here, you know, you're in the subway, and everybody's pushing and shoving, and you're like, oh, my God, I got to get used to it. Also, people touching you. You know, my girlfriend, every time she used to touch me, I used to winch because I'm not used to touching because, you know, every time somebody touched you was in a bad way, you know. But and those kind of things. And then there is the things that you're not even aware of, you know, things, ideas that you've adopted that you don't even know that you've adopted. And it is very hard, you know, and you have to, you know, you really have to, you need space, you need time. And unfortunately, when you get out, the system just wants to rush you. They want to throw you into a job. They want you to find a job immediately. And really what you need is a vacation to unload and unburden yourself and realize, you know, gee, I don't have to. When somebody looks at me, it's not a challenge. It's just he's just looking at me. You know, when somebody bumps me, it's not because he wants to bump me. And he's, you know, and it doesn't necessarily have to be violence. But a lot of people don't have the support and don't have the people in their lives to help them. And that's terrible. And especially now they're releasing all these guys and they're cutting funding. And like Fortune Society does what it does. But it's, even then, you know, we need funding. We need people to contribute because there are a lot of people that need someone there to guide them and say, listen, it's okay. You know, it's okay to cry and it's okay to feel sad and it's okay to feel happy and it's okay to feel nervous and scared. I mean, that's the first thing I noticed when I got out here, that everybody was afraid. I was wondering, Why is everybody afraid? I just came from a scary place. You know, and I could, you know, and there are things like that that you discover about the world that you're like, wow, I can't believe it.
Angel Ramos, thanks very much for your time. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Angel Ramos spent 30 years in prison after being convicted of murder. He currently works as a counselor for the Fortune Society and joined us from our bureau in New York. I think sitting next to them there in our bureau in New York is Jacqueline Jackie Smith, who served 10 years in a federal prison for interstate drug trafficking, unlawful possession of drugs with intent to distribute. She currently works as a kitchen manager in New York and is a spokesperson for a nonprofit agency, the Women's Prison Association, also there from our bureau in New York. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And I heard you, I think, laughing at some of the things that Angel was talking about.
Yeah, because it's so true. And he's speaking, and I'm like, wow. I'm like agreeing like 100% because what he's saying is real.
What surprised you the most when you got out?
How everything had changed. You know, I wasn't prepared. Like, I got on the bus, and nobody told me about the bus. You know, you put your little card in, and it like snatched it right out of my hand, and I, you know, kind of went crazy. They like, no, it's okay. That's how it's a... I'm like, how come nobody told me? You know, it was just the technology of how everything changed, and it just took time getting used to that.
And walking out on the street and seeing all these people talking to themselves. It turns out they're on cell phones.
Yeah, that's another thing. I'm still not 100% on the cell phones. I'm still bringing myself, you know, up to grade. Upgrading, so to speak.
We're talking about life after many years in prison, what it's like to adjust to the outside. In a few minutes, another former inmate who's now a lawyer will share his story, and we'll take more of your calls. 800-989-8255. You can also send us email. The address is talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Cownan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Cownan in Washington. Most people realize that life in prison is difficult, to say the least. As we've heard, life after prison brings its challenges, too. We're talking with former prisoners today about getting out and how each of them adjusted to the outside after many years behind bars. If you've been through this, give us a call. Or if you want to know more about the experience, our number is 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. You can also check out what other listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Jackie Smith is still with us. She served 10 years in a federal prison for drug-related offenses and currently works as a kitchen manager in New York. And we have this email from Danielle, who says, I have a cousin who will be getting out in about a year. He's been in for 5. He will be staying with me. Any advice on how I can help him adjust?
I would just... you know, try to understand and be compassionate when you have a person, you know, just coming home, they're coming into your space. So at some point they're going to feel like they are burdened to you because they don't have a job and they're relying on you for a lot of things. So, you know, just being understanding and just try to be supportive and help guide them in the right direction as far as looking for employment. You might want to go with that person and make them feel comfortable moving around and traveling and learning the city, how to ride the buses, and, you know, just bring them up to speed of what's going on in society since they've been away.
Let's get Greg on the line. Greg is calling us from Bend in Oregon.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, go ahead, Greg.
Yes, I was convicted of... counterfeiting money back in the mid-80s, and was sentenced to 7 years in federal prison. And it was, of course, a huge mistake on my part, but the results of it were quite unexpected in terms of what it was like to deal with being in the system. It was the impact on people's families that stick by them, which is actually somewhat rare. Most people that do, my parole officer told me that in 13 years he had only seen about, he could count on one hand how many people's wives stayed with them after 6 months even. And so there's a lot of emotional anger and heartache and grief that you have to deal with. And a line from the movie Grapes of Wrath, where he had gotten out of jail and was his mom wanted to know if it had made him mad and mean. If you want to train a guard dog to be mean, you put him on a short leash. And this is often the emotional result of people being incarcerated. Hmm. And how people spend their time, of course, varies greatly. And one thing that I noticed is a lot of people would just kind of veg out, watch TV, work out, etc. And some people studied and read things and tried to improve their lives and use the time gracefully and usefully. But there's a big disparity between the punishment of being in jail is much more severe on certain people, mostly in relationship to when they're in jail. There are people that really don't value their time or their freedom that much. The punishment is somewhat light on them. It's three hots and a flop. And for people that really value their freedom, it is quite a bit more severe. Mm-hmm. So it is quite unequal, and of course, it would be impossible to try to equalize that.
I was going to say, Jackie Smith, I wanted to ask you what Greg was saying about reconnecting with your family. Was that difficult for you?
It wasn't as difficult, but like I said, once you're at your sister's house or, somebody in your fam, you with them, you're in their place. So, I mean, they have their own rules and you have your own way of how you do things, and you can't come to somebody else's house and try to take over. It's just not going to work. You know, even though that's your family and they love you, you still got to respect, this is her house. I can't, if the kids can run and do this and, whereas I'm like, sit down and keep this clean, you can't, that's their house. I can't dictate how someone else run their household. And it wasn't difficult because my family was very, once I got out, they was very, there for me, doing what they can to support me and stuff. But for me, I wanted more for myself. I've been living with women for forever. Please, I need my space, and that was my attitude. So I just tried to do what I can to better myself, to, show them that I need your help, but help me help myself,
Greg, thanks very much for the call.
Could I make one more comment?
Yeah, go ahead.
One thing that was really noticeable and somewhat different for me when I got out is that there's quite a pecking order, in especially in federal prison. And I was considered kind of high on the pecking order because I had done what was considered a skilled crime. And I actually did not have trouble getting a job when I got out, but I actually was taken advantage of by my employers in an ironic sort of way. I even had an employer like whispering to some of his better clients, "Hey, you got to see who I got back here running the press," and it was quite odd in that respect. I felt disrespected and used by that in a strange way, and to this day, that still stings a little bit.
Okay, Greg, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Let's see if we can get another caller on, and this is Calvin. Calvin with us from Michigan.
How are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
I just want to see if I can get your guest to comment on whether the system or how the system worked to impede or to assist them in their reintegration back into society. I served 15 years in the Michigan State Penitentiary for robbery, and as I began to get close to coming home, I started putting away money, and I put away about $800, and I intended to use this money to ease myself back into society.
This was from a prison job?
Yes, from a prison job, right, and it's hard. You don't make a lot of money in there, so this is about 3 years' worth of saving. And, I wanted to use this money to get back, to ease myself back into society, maybe rent a home, a room, or something like that. And I found that I was unable to get that money for 2 months, and this is typical. And they don't provide you with ID, things that you just normally need to reintegrate and get back into society. You apply for a job, you need identification. And it seems to me like the system could do more to assist in the reintegration back into society.
Jackie Smith, is that right? You don't have any ID when you get
out? I agree 100% because it was so, I mean, when I came home, I went to like 3 DMVs before one of the supervisors actually felt sorry for me and was like, let me see what she got, because I had my prison ID. You don't supposed to bring it out, but I snuck it out anyway because I figured it would be a help to help me get ID, because all I had was my birth certificate and my Social Security card, which I sent off for prior to me being released. And they sent it back. The counselors give it back to you when you get ready to leave. And I had these documents, the release papers they gave me, plus the ID card. And I took it, you know, this is all I have, you know, and a letter from the halfway house. And they would not give it to me. And the lady was like, let me see what she got. And she was like, give it to her. Because that was like the 3rd DMV that I had went to. And they was like, you don't have enough points. And they was like, oh, no, that's a federal ID card. If you had a state ID, we will honor it, because it's some agreement with the state that they have.
Right.
If you have a state ID, then you can get your non-driver's, you know, a New York State ID.
And Jackie, you're now a kitchen manager. You've got a good job.
Mm-hmm.
Have you been able to get a credit card?
Yes, I have. I mean, it took time. It took time. At first, everywhere deny me. But over time, I established myself and, you know, got my first credit card, $100 limit. I said, okay, that's a start, you know, and I've just, you know, been doing better. Been doing much better.
Calvin, thanks very much for the call. Good question.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye. And as you look ahead, Jacqueline Smith, how did you get that job as a kitchen manager? And was it sounds like it wasn't easy for you either.
No, it wasn't. But in the halfway house, they had a coordinator that would set people up with jobs. And the first job I had was at a clothing store in the city. And I liked the job. It was pretty good. But I love being in the kitchen. So that's something I wanted to do. And he said, the company that I was working for at the time was hiring. So I went down there. You know, I didn't know what to say because, like I said, I've been locked up for 10 years. I mean, what do I put on the application? Do I put all the jobs I did in prison? Or do I, you know, I mean, where do I go? I mean, I was just lost for what information to put down there because I didn't want them to see, okay, all prison. Okay, well, where is this? Isn't everything was in prison for the last 10 years. So, I mean, but I just sat down before I even filled out the application and spoke to him. But then the counselor had already told, you know, the employer about the situation. So he already knew, you know, so that helped out, too. And then, you know, he didn't have a problem with hiring me. And when they did the interview, you know, the manager, he was like, you know, I got a good feeling about you. And, you know, they gave me a chance, and I worked for that company for like 5 years.
Well, congratulations, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
Jackie Smith joined us from New York. She served 10 years in a federal prison for interstate drug trafficking, and talk about her problems with reconnecting with her family and finding a job. There are 1 in 5 prisoners who have a job lined up upon their release, according to the Urban Institute. And according to, again, the Bureau of Justice Statistics in 2003, 68% of state prisoners lack a high school diploma. And according to the last study done, and that was back in 1994, more than 2/3 of prisoners released are rearrested within 3 years. Joining us now is Roland Acevedo. He was convicted of armed robbery on 2 separate occasions and spent about 10 years in jail altogether. He's currently an attorney in private practice with Seif, Kretz, and Abercrombie in New York City. And he joins us now from the studios of member station WFUV on the campus of Fordham University in the Bronx. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil.
And you're a repeat offender, as we just mentioned there. How quickly after your first release were you charged and convicted again?
Within 60 days. I was back so quickly that some of my friends didn't even know I left.
And that's sadly the case with too many people who get out of prison.
Well, that goes to the whole issue with there being an adequate transition period. So some people are not prepared to go from a very structured setting in prison to society, so when it's unleashed on you, there's a frustration factor that leads you back to the same behavior that put you in prison in the first place.
But as we also mentioned, you're an attorney. How did that happen?
Well, a lot of hard work, plenty of luck and lots of support by, you know, people who have established themselves in the legal community.
We're talking with Roland Acevedo. He's our guest. He's a former prisoner convicted of armed robbery on two separate occasions. He's now an attorney and working in private practice in New York City. You're listening to Talk of the Nation, coming to you from NPR News. And Roland, did you have problems finding housing or reconnecting with your family after you were released?
I did, Neil. When I first got out, when I got out the second time, because there was nothing to talk about getting out the first time. I was back so quickly. But when I got out the second time, I planned to go into a homeless-type program out in Long Island. But my parents picked me up, and on the way to the shelter, you know, my dad and mom suggested that I just come home and stay with them. They had a one-bedroom, so I was sleeping on the couch. But I was happy. I was very happy to have the couch. I wasn't complaining.
Let's see if we can get some more. Here's an email we have from Jonathan in Tallahassee. I've heard many inmates who may even receive professional training in prison are unable to practice a large number of professions because they're legally barred from getting a license. I was wondering if any of the panelists have dealt with this problem.
Yeah, I represent lots of people who have licensing problems, including some lawyers. I recently worked on a case where a person with a similar criminal background as mine was admitted as an attorney in New Jersey, but has been denied repeatedly when he is tried for admission here in New York. So I've worked on a couple of cases like that. I've testified at various character committees for people with felony backgrounds who are applying to be attorneys. So I see that often.
Let's get Jane on the line. Jane is calling us from California.
Hi, hello.
Hi, Jane.
Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
I'm a deputy district attorney in the Central Valley, and I send people to prison on a regular basis. What I see a lot is that some people never really escape the prison culture, which is, you know, a completely different counterculture to the one on the outside, and it's really quite tragic. For example, I recently had a victim of an attempted murder. He had 3 gunshot wounds, but he himself was a parolee, and because of that, he refused to testify against the person who shot him and tried to kill him because he would be classified as a snitch in prison. And seeing cases like this multiple times, yeah, I'm just saddened by the prospect of his life on the outside. He's carried over that prison culture to the outside, and I fear that he will never escape it.
Roland Acevedo, is Jane right? A lot of people never lose that prison culture?
Jane is correct, but I think there's reasons why they don't lose it. You need a certain code of conduct, as your first guest, Angel, mentioned, to survive in prison. And, you know, we are what we eat. If you live that conduct long enough, it grows on you. It becomes part of you. It's no different than you know, taking an animal in the jungle. They do what they have to do to survive, and people who are put in the prison setting do what they have to do to survive. To break that cycle, you need to educate people and give them opportunities. So you can't expect someone to change their colors when they're released back to society, but they don't have any opportunities in housing, in employment, in social programs. The stuff is just not there to assist with the transition.
Jane, I think California is one of the states where such programs have been cut back over the years. Is that a problem, do you think?
Oh, definitely. I would certainly agree on that, and I think it changes from county to county. And it's really sad that there isn't more rehabilitation while that goes on and educational programs on the inside. But really, we just don't have the resources for it. And unfortunately, I don't think we're really getting to the root of the problem when we send these people to prison.
Jane, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And Roland Acevedo, I just can give you 30 seconds to respond to that last point about rehabilitation and the lack of services and the lack of resources.
I mean, rehabilitation should focus on education. every parent in this country realizes the value of education. If you want to break that cycle of crime, of drug abuse, of violence, you need to educate people. Education opens minds. Education opens doors. That's the panacea. That's the remedy.
Roland Acevedo, thanks very much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Roland Acevedo, currently an attorney in private practice in New York, with us today from member station WFUV on the campus of Fordham University in the Bronx. Coming up, flipping stereotypes on their head, we'll talk with their blogger behind Stuff White People Like, Oscar Parties, Study Abroad, and The Bicycle are a few things he mentions. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.